Existing residential, more commercial, mixed in. Here's some more residential right next to commercial. And the new development at Grand Oaks coming online shortly, which has more of that pedestrian-oriented frontage. So the new mixed-use zoning district, here's a vision precedent image. And it's while it's really characterized by these small, narrow lots, this zoning district has a vision for a variety of uses and flexibility and standards due to those site constraints. But really with a focus on uses that confront on El Camino Real and enhance the pedestrian experience. I'll scroll through a few images here of what we could envision for the corridor. Active spaces, a consistent street wall. And here's another recent example from SLO. So this zoning district, we'd like to spend a little bit more time on. It requires kind of careful consideration and just a little bit more discussion because so many of these parcels are so small and narrow and development is so constrained, especially mid-block. It makes it very difficult to fit in the parking for commercial uses along with a commercial use and the residential use and the parking for residential use. It just doesn't often fit. And we should also consider some other factors that can lead to just inhibiting development and inhibiting this type of vertical mixed use from happening. Ground floor retail is frequently underwritten with really conservative assumptions, which can have negative implications for project financing. And we just really don't want vacant ground floor spaces. It's a negative amenity. It harms other uses. It doesn't look good. And it just doesn't add anything to the city. So kind of bottom line, requiring vertical mixed use with a blanket commercial requirement for all types of development is likely to deter investment and can lead to some poor outcomes in certain locations, including higher vacancy rates, especially among developers who don't usually develop commercial spaces. So a little bit of background too, in Atascadero, there is a lot of existing retail, but it's generally lots of small spaces, not a lot of new and high quality spaces. So a majority of the city's retail spaces are smaller than 5,000 square feet, which is what we would certainly see in a lot of these parcels. And while there's a lot of inventory here in the city, it's not necessarily perfectly aligned with consumer preferences. And we see that in the vacancy rate. We've seen a low of 3.3% in 2018 and a high of 9.8% in 2022. And this compares to a lower vacancy rate at the county at large. And even at the city's peak occupancy, its retail market never achieved the same levels as the county at large. So improving that quantity, the quality, I think, and the desirability of the types of retail offerings can really be a major opportunity to enhance the city's quality of life for residents, advance economic development. But to do that, the city should really target that retail in locations that it best performs. Corners, downtown, and larger mixed-use areas. We need to right-size the retail spaces. So these kinds of standards that really support the city's vision with ground floor retail that works, we need to figure out what are the right sizes that fit into the space and that are marketable and leasable. Continuous ground floor retail, the length of a corridor, doesn't necessarily right size the retail for high marketability. The best practice approach is to instead require that retail at those key intersections around civic institutions like downtown, at established commercial nodes, and really kind of get away from the long expanse. We want to make sure that we are requiring usable spaces that will function well when they're rented. And sometimes that means making them flexible, allowing a lot of different uses, a lot of different restaurants, offices, personal services, and also large enough spaces, not being too prescriptive with the right sizing of it. And then, of course, residential density. Retail survives on having units within a quarter mile and continuous pedestrian flow. So when we design these spaces for walkability with frequent doors and shade and trees, slow traffic, this human scale rhythm really does support the vision that we're looking for. But we want to avoid what we've seen other cities do when implementing mixed use, having really prescriptive 3 to 5 story mixed use everywhere and a mandatory ground floor requirement on a wide auto corridor does tend to lead to high vacancy rates. So as part of our discussion today, we'll present 3 different options for this mixed use one district, given its kind of more unique constraints with lot sizes and a desire to really drill in on best practices about how can we make retail work best and inform our regulations. So the first option we'd like to discuss is the most restrictive. This is where we would require ground floor commercial on every parcel. So we would require anyone who's redeveloping to include a commercial component in a vertical mixed use kind of structure. And given the size of most of these parcels, this would be pretty difficult. And the outcome of this can often be vacant storefronts. Or if not vacant, still use that really doesn't engage the street or enhance the pedestrian experience, just given the amount of retail. Another option would be to protect corner parcels. As we said, those intersections are key places to make sure that we have our commercial pieces. So we want to protect those corner parcels that can accommodate commercial and residential and mixed use, require ground floor commercial there, but then consider providing a little bit more flexibility mid-block. So allow potentially residential uses on the ground floor mid-block, but with standards that would allow the use to transfer back to commercial uses easily. So set a minimum ground floor height that's higher than standard residential spaces. Make sure that there's adequate depth in building function and form to accommodate a commercial space with adequate window glazing and direct sidewalk entrances. So to have that flexibility in the future for change. So this type of regulation would allow a fluid use of the ground floor space where corners such as this have a ground floor commercial requirement. But then mid-block, as seen here, you may have residential. So the corner here has a restaurant use, but mid-block, there's high ground floor ceiling heights. This example doesn't exactly fit the bill though, because it's really lacking that adequate glazing and interface with the street to really function as a good commercial space later. But here's an example that might work, a more flexible ground floor space that could really be commercial or residential with the flexibility to follow the market or the individual property owner's desires, really more of a form kind of forward look at regulating. So the final option to discuss would be to provide even more flexibility. Again, preserving those corner parcels for commercial or mixed use development, but allowing standalone residential mid-block and without requiring that kind of, it looks like commercial uses as the option two would. And this would just be, again, in this mixed use one zoning district. So we could envision again, the corners with ground floor retail space, but next to standalone residential uses of varying types and styles, that would fit within the existing context, which is already a mix of residential and commercial uses, and ending again with corner parcels providing that mixed use activity center. So as we think through these three options, we'll want to talk about where specifically this applies. We cross-hatched to show the corner parcels in this zone. So this is where commercial ground floor uses in option 2 and 3 would be required. But as we were thinking about this, we realized, there are also some other kind of major shopping centers within this zone that we may want to require some sort of vertical mixed use if it were to redevelop. So those parcels are called out here in the darker blue, where we could actually consider changing these to a mixed use four option, the mixed use four zoning district designation to require it to have vertical mixed use in some of those locations. But then where those in those areas where it is a kind of already a mix of residential and commercial uses have the additional flexibility that one of the other options might provide. And here again is just a review of the existing land uses for context. So the standards for the mixed-use one zoning district, again, intended to facilitate that vision and recognize the existing constraints of the small, shallow parcels. Density, again, is 36 units to the acre, same height of 35 feet. Setbacks for commercial would include a maximum setback to avoid parking between the building and the street. So not a minimum, but a maximum so that we don't have parking lots in front of the building. No side or rear setbacks would be required unless transitioning to a single-family zoning district. Ground floor height, here again, we could see it being a little bit higher to support that high-quality retail space. And uses along this stretch can vary. Any hotels, restaurants, retail services, gyms, offices. Really, the constraint here that you wouldn't have is industrial and auto repair type uses. And the location of residential buildings, whether allowed as horizontal mixed use, some standalone residential, or all vertical mixed use, that's yet to be determined based on a discussion with council tonight. So we'll loop back to discuss mixed use one at the end of the presentation. But in summary, the four mixed use zoning districts are really intended to provide that opportunity for commercial residential development unique in each of the areas. And just in summary, we have fairly consistent density, except for in mixed use two, consistent height across the four zoning districts, where we do see some variation. And I did notice, I apologize, there's a typo here on mixed use three. Earlier, we said 14 feet. And again, that's where we have a little bit too much nuance between the heights between these. And we don't have to dwell on that too much tonight, other than to kind of hear from you if it makes sense to have, a more kind of a maybe a 12-foot height in mixed use two and three, and a 15 or 16 in one and four, which is probably where we would recommend. And again, the vertical and horizontal mixed use is really one of the key differentiators between these districts, where vertical mixed use is required versus where horizontal mixed use would be allowed. So that concludes the presentation portion of this. And then I'll turn it back to Phil for general discussion and then the bifurcation of the different districts.
Thank you, Genevieve. And actually, I'm going to defer to the mayor because there's also an opportunity, I'm sure, that council has questions about various factors here. And of course, then we have public comment, and then we can kind of go to the bifurcation and discussion. But I'm also going to think our city attorney might want to weigh in as well as to how we should proceed from here. Thank you.
Okay, yes, I had a question for the city attorney before we proceed. As noted on the slide, we're looking at continuing the discussion of mixed use three to March 24th because we have two council members own property in the area posed for discussion, and Mayor Pro Tem Dara is being absent, would only leave two, so we're not going to discuss that, except that I was wondering on mixed use three, and council could tell me if this is an appropriate relevant question, is how I was confused by what consists, the basic question being which, you know, are the parcels the right parcels to be discussing? Because I was confused about the combination of the San Anselmo, San Paolo properties with the Morrow Road properties. Can we just discuss that March 24th? Or do we need to, if we're going to discuss something like that, whether it should even be included in the mixed use three area?
Yeah, I think if you're going to be talking about anything related to mixed use three, defer that to the March 24th so that you'll have three people on to discuss that. There may be some concerns that Councilmember Darris or Mayor Pro Tem Darris has that would like to be included in that
Absolutely.
Discussion.
Okay, very good. I just wouldn't want to say then we get to March 24th and go, wait, let's, you know, some of these properties, maybe they belong in mixed use or something.
Sure.
So, okay. And then my last question is for, as we proceed towards, normally we're going to take questions, council member questions first, then we'd go to the public, then come back for discussion. And we're indicating here that for mixed use two, there'd be a recusal. But if there's going to be a recusal during the discussion, I'm assuming that same council member needs to recuse during discussion should not be asking questions during the discussion of mixed use too?
Generally, the short answer is going to be yes as to that particular zone. What I want to talk about, if with the council's permission, is a little bit more at a broader level of what the conflicts involve. Under the Political Reform Act, there are certain specific rules about conflicts of interest, and a council member generally is not supposed to make or participate in making a decision about things that might have a material financial impact on their personal interests. And so what we do when we look at every decision that is coming to the council, we try to determine whether or not any of the council members have a potential conflict of interest. We try to raise that at the earliest possible point and provide maximum opportunity for the council members to participate and just make those minimal cutouts or carve-outs, if you will, on the decisions so that the council members who have conflicts are not affected by the broader discussion. So, for example, in the broader general plan, we want to make sure that the council members have every opportunity to participate in the grand process of the general plan and the zoning amendments, excluding only those situations on which they have conflicts. Conflicts are not a bad thing. I like to say that they're a good thing because council members who have real property conflicts, for example, or business interest conflicts, mean they're invested in the community. I had a city where just about every meeting, the mayor had to recuse himself from one or another matter because he owned half of the downtown area in that city. And it showed that he had a deep commitment, connection to the community. I think the same can be said of just about any city council where you have these conflicts arise. So conflicts are not a bad thing. They're just something that the Political Reform Act requires certain actions, and the action is recusal. Very briefly, what we look at when we're looking at the conflicts is we have heat maps or radius maps. We look at the real property interests that council members have, and then we look at a 500-foot radius, 500 to 1,000 foot, and outside 1,000 foot. So if a council member has property within 500 feet of a particular property that is going to be considered by the council for a change in use, change in zoning, then there's a conflict under the FPPC rules. Between 500 and 1,000 feet, there's a little bit different analysis, and outside 1,000 feet, there's a different analysis still. So that's what we do on our end in consultation with staff to try to make sure that the council members are not going to get in trouble with the FPPC and otherwise are allowed to participate the maximum amount that they can. I understand conflict analysis can be frustrating because it seems like it's an impingement on the opportunity for a council member to speak about a particular policy matter, but there is a First Amendment exemption where a council member who is recused from a particular matter can speak in favor of their own personal financial interests as long as they're not speaking from the dais. So that's kind of a very broad brush view of what the conflicts are. Moving forward, we will have this analysis for pretty much every time we come back with anything related to the general plan or the zoning code. When you come back for adoption of the general plan and the zoning code, you'll see multiple resolutions, multiple ordinances, and those are what we call segmentation. We're carving out the maximum participation for the council, exempting only those small portions where certain council members have conflicts of interest. So that's the road ahead. Happy to answer any individual questions on it, but that's why we do this.
Okay. Thank you, Council, and we appreciate the explanation. I think it's important for the public to hear that as well. And yes, because we do want to ensure maximum participation as possible by all council members. And so if we need to split things out sometimes, we're more than happy to do that. I'd like to then, we'll go ahead and begin discussion, or not discussion, but begin questions. Let's just kind of go down the list as shown on this slide, and we'll start with the mixed use four. And I'll defer to my start on my left with Councilmember Peake with any questions you have regarding the mixed use four discussion. Sure. We'll go back to Councilmember Peake. I'll defer to Councilmember Funk. And let me ask everybody, though, all of you, you know, this is an extremely important item we're going over here. This is kind of, you know, I think one of the key reasons a lot of people run for council is providing guidance for the future of the city, the economic development of the city, and zoning is just a critical piece of that. So this, we could have a lot of questions this evening, but so let's try to get to the questions as quick as possible. So thanks.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to come back to this, and this would apply to all the zoning districts. But first of all, the requirements that we're talking about, are these ones that a developer could get a waiver from under the state density bonus program if they added sufficient affordable housing units? And does that happen very often? If not, why not?
Thank you, Councilmember. The waivers would apply to any property development standards like height and setbacks and other things like that. So they could get those. Do they get them very often? They typically don't go for those types of waivers because the objective design standards already give them a lot of freedom, but certainly an option.
Okay. And I want to talk about street trees for a second. Am I reasonable in understanding that the main objective of street trees is to avoid having, you know, the concrete jungle effect of buildings squishing up together, and you're in this sort of, you know, tunnel of concrete, and you want to have street trees to break that up? Is that a fair assumption?
Street trees have several functions. A primary one is architecture, it's design, it's aesthetic. Another one also, though, is just shade, heat buildup, comfort, and places for people to congregate.
Okay. And is it, are there places that give you the flexibility to trade off a little tree at the front of a property versus maybe a big tree that might be back in the courtyard area of a property? So that, you know, if you had a valley oak or something there that eventually is going to be taller than your three-story building and provide a lot of shade, but might not be out there where it affects, but you wouldn't allow a setback for that purpose.
Yeah, our current code does not have any exceptions for that. They would need to go through a conditional use permit process for any exception to any design standards in our code. And the primary purpose of the street trees is to break up the concrete. We do not have street trees and sidewalks outside of downtown, and so the street frontage is the only location where we can get any sort of landscaping on these other corridors.
Okay. And at some point, was there essentially a council practice of pushing, or a city practice of pushing street trees, creating additional setbacks so that street trees could sit on a private ownership property so the city wouldn't have to maintain them?
That is generally where street trees have been planted historically, except for in the downtown.
Okay. And if we allowed more flexibility on who has to maintain the street tree or which right, let street trees be occurring in certain right-of-ways, could we allow buildings to be closer to the sidewalk?
I'm going to hand that question over to Director DeBar to talk about sidewalk widths and our ability to maintain street trees.
Thank you. So as Ms. Gleason mentioned, that in the downtown, a lot of times the street trees are in the right-of-way, and then outside of that, they're often on private property. Also, a lot of the roads in town, the private property ownership goes to the center line of the road, and there's an easement over those properties. So, you know, the city's ordinance is that the adjacent property owner is responsible to maintain the boulevard area of the right-of-way up to the edge of the pavement. So that includes trees, sidewalks, all of those things. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question or not, but street trees and sidewalk areas, we usually try to have like a 5x5 cutout for it in the sidewalk to give it adequate room to grow and be watered and everything else. We've gone as small as 3x3, but often those we in the downtown that have been there a long time were actually removed with our downtown project. But they do also exist in other areas on Lewis and other places in town, but they don't do very well, and they seem to be stunted when they are in smaller tree wall cutouts. I'm not sure if that answered your question.
Are the setbacks? I mean, we have a lot of places where we're talking, and I can't remember if MU4 was one of them, where the issue was that the front setback is governed by what it takes for street trees.
Correct.
So I'm wanting to find out, is that further governed by us wanting to push off responsibility of who's maintaining the street tree, or is that independent?
Yeah, I think the responsibility still lies with the budding property owner, regardless if it's in the city right away or in that setback. I agree that having a setback for landscape buffer on private property next to the right of way, as shown in this exhibit, is preferable because often, you know, it gives more room for landscaping and softening that facade for the buildings. It also, you know, a lot of times it's a shady, it's a taller building. Sun doesn't really get to that tree, and then it starts growing out towards the center of the street or away from the building. So having the setback is, you know, preferential for the tree growth.
Yeah. Okay. But for MU4, we're talking about properties that are on El Camino. So there's, you know, this huge state highway width of street there, which is plenty of opportunity for sun to get to anything. And plenty of opportunity not to have a concrete jungle. So what I'm getting, what I'm trying to find out is if there's opportunity for more flexibility in our setback requirements, if we were more flexible in how we accommodated street trees.
Yeah, I think, you know, we have a number of different types of street trees that could be suitable for different areas. So like a Chinese pistache would be a smaller tree. You know, or sycamore is a much larger tree, or crepe myrtle is even a smaller tree that could fit in some of these smaller corridor areas where we need, you know, we'd need to maintain, you know, around these trees 3 to 4 feet of clearance for the sidewalk, ADA compliance. So a lot of it is dictated by that, as well as how wide is a sidewalk and what can we fit in there, and things of that nature, and cross slopes.
Okay. And do our the standards that we're proposing for this for MU4 allow some flexibility so that you could have building pullback tree, building the trees planted in insets of the building, which breaks up the frontage of the building, accommodates the trees, and still we have that, you know, lovely width of El Camino to allow sunshine to get to them.
Yeah, and I did want to make clear that the street tree standard is our current standard in our code. So we're not proposing any changes to that standard with these zoning districts. That's currently what is required for setbacks and street trees. So our street tree standard, the reason we don't set just a minimum setback is our street tree standard does allow for that flexibility. So if you plant larger trees, they're spaced farther apart, and then your building can undulate in between those trees. If you choose to do smaller trees, your building might set back less from the back of the sidewalk. And you can do a straight building face, which is, from a construction standpoint, sometimes desirable. And then you plant smaller trees at a smaller spacing.
Okay. I'm checking my questions because I didn't parse my questions by zoning district.
We also have a graphic up on the screen.
If you have an MPO 4 question. I understand what you're saying because if we're going to switch, so you can sort out if you have any more MPO 4 questions. I'll go down to Councilmember Newsom.
Thank you. I have some general questions. What is the noticing process on any of the parcels? Because we do have some that are listed by their parcel number. What is the noticing requirement for any changes that we're currently evaluating? Is it an ad in the newspaper? Are any of these parcels directly contacted? Because we have some that are listed under MU1, but with the potential to move into MU4.
I'll go ahead and handle this one. I think generally when you're dealing with a general plan or zoning code updates to large number of parcels, the typical method's going to be advertising in a local newspaper and through the city's website. By contrast, when the council hears either an appeal of a planning commission decision or the planning commission hears a project, there'll be a radius around that project of about 300 feet that's required by state law to be notified. Because there are so many parcels that are potentially at issue within the general plan update and the zoning code, noticing every parcel within 300 feet would be a significant undertaking, both to identify the parcels and the cost involved in that. So because it's a policy change as opposed to a parcel-specific change like would be done at the Planning Commission, I would expect that those noticings would be done on a broader level.
So if we have these parcels that have been identified specifically on parcel numbers from switching from an MU1 to an MU4, were those five parcel owners notified specifically one-on-one?
At this point, no. If the council were to direct that at the time the adoption came forward on that, certainly that would be an opportunity for the city to do that. If, for example, the council said, we'd like the staff to notify a 500-foot radius around any parcel that is going to be changed from one existing use to another, or the zoning is going to be changed, that's certainly something we could look at. But I can't give you a magnitude of how big that would be at this point until the council gives a little bit further direction on that. And I don't know if Mr. Dunsmore or Ms. Gleason had any thoughts on that.
Just something to note as well, that this is brand new zoning for every parcel shown in the mixed use district. Okay. So we're not necessarily changing one from the other. We are looking at mixed use zoning afresh today because we have not discussed that before with our zoning code update in compliance with the general plan. And we have options for the extent of those zoning districts for certain locations. So all of the parcels shown under the mixed use zone are not zoned that today.
Okay. The only thing I'd be concerned is that we're looking at a map that specifically targets these five entities and we haven't made contact with them, so they don't understand what we're currently hearing today. And I know this is a broad change because it's general plan. That's what allows us to all sit up here without a recusal. Just want to make sure as we're looking at those parcels that before we move them to a zone, it'd be nice to know what their thoughts or feelings would be on, you know, forthcoming mixed use areas. The next question I have is, if we do make these existing general plan changes, those that are non-conforming to the change that they have or the zoning they had to the new zoning, do they get grandfathered in?
Thank you for that question, Council. The situation here with applying mixed-use districts will generally, I think, in all of these circumstances, allow the existing land uses that are there if those land uses are current and, or actually consistent with our current commercial zoning now. So in other words, these mixed-use districts will continue to allow commercial land uses as the predominant land use. The future will simply add mixed use, the residential layer, onto that and add property development standards onto that. So, for example, a lot of the imagery you saw where we have the strip malls and we have the retail, those things would not become non-conforming with these new mixed-use zoning additions. These just add development standards for new development and add the addition bonus of adding the residential in most cases.
Isn't it correct in a few of the mixed-use zones we're going to take away automotive repair and a few others where we're being a little bit more restrictive in those mixed-use areas?
So those areas are already potentially non-conforming. So what we're doing is we're taking areas that are now retail for the most part and adding this mixed-use layer. Right now, today, these auto services, auto repair are allowed in service commercial zones and industrial zones. We can take a look and closer look at that. There may be a potential for a couple locations. But in many circumstances throughout the general plan where we're changing zoning, it may create non-conformities, not just in mixed-use districts, but in other areas where we're changing or consolidating or trying to create additional neighborhood compatibility as the city grows and progresses.
Yeah, and I know we underwent that having downtown and having Clem's and having that non-conforming in an area which we wanted to have revitalized. But under MU4, it lists that industrial auto repair oriented uses are not allowed. That's under current standard, or is that projected new zoning change?
I believe both. Let me just double check the map. I'm going to go back to that real quick. And
I'm not saying I know right offhand if we have something fitting that, but I know that we are changing some of the zoning restrictions in an M4. It's taking away the automotive use.
And again, what we're going to be doing at our next hearing is talking about the lists of allowed uses. And so that's where we can dial in. And if the council wanted to cater certain land use districts, even in these mixed use areas, we can do that at that time.
But currently on the properties proposed to be part of MU4, I don't believe there are any automotive related uses, and they're not currently zoned, which is, I think, the key question that Councilmember Newsom is asking is, are we taking anything away from an existing property owner?
As we look at any of the zones, I think we need to really make sure that we're not taking away or making somebody be a non-conforming that hasn't been directly involved in a public outreach to say, how does that affect, or how does your interpretation of moving from MU4 to MU1, or how does this zoning change when we put more stricter restrictions, how does that affect? I know early on when we were looking at nodes in different developments through different corridors and a global scheme of things years ago was is to make sure that we weren't changing someone's ability to use their personal property the way that they had bought it, intended, or were currently operating it. That's all my questions on MU4.
Thank you. I'm going to sort of follow up on her question, though. Because I'm looking at this map, and you just had a different map. It seemed like a different color for this. yes, that. Okay, this is existing uses. Okay, gotcha. Because I just want to kind of confirm my comment, though, that currently there are no automotive-type uses in these MU4 areas, right?
That is correct.
Okay. But I think the is it that inaccurate? Is Figueroa in there, though, or are they a little farther down? Okay. So, but they're existing. We're not taking anything away because they would be grandfathered in if Figueroa is within that thing. And my question, though, and also in terms of notifications is, you know, this is a pretty important discussion, but, you know, I see maybe one property owner remaining here in the audience this evening. So it's a little bit of a concern. I see in this particular MU4, most of these properties seem like they're corporate owned. They're existing commercial enterprises. Some of them are, you know, large for our community, I guess. And so maybe they wouldn't be here. But to your point, Mr. Dunsmore, we are effectively through this mixed use discussion, adding allowable uses. to these properties, you know, and so their existing use is not going to become non-conforming, you know, grandfathered in. It's a matter of we're essentially allowing additional potential uses, particularly the addition of housing. Was that a fair understanding?
Yes, for the most part, that's how it is. Now, of course, we're modernizing the land use list to reflect the demand we're seeing in these areas. But for the most part, we're adding this mixed-use layer, adding this new addition.
Right. Okay. Well, I think that's very critical to understand, though, because I think you sense that the council is very concerned if we're going to ever take away somebody's current right to do something, it's extra critical that they be notified that that's under consideration by council. By the city. But if we're talking about adding, then I'm not so concerned that they're not here tonight to discuss that, because we're essentially adding an allowable use for them, which yes. I realize is going to be done down the road in an ordinance, but we are talking about it tonight. We're giving guidance tonight.
Yes, you are. And if council so chooses, you can give us direction as you're speaking now to include land uses that we have in there so that they don't become non-conforming with the land use list, for example. You did note that Figueroa Tire is within this retail zone in the MU4. That is correct. It is on the east side of El Camino at the very south end, just north of Arcade Road there. We looked at the map just now. So that's the one probably in all of MU4 that I can think of that... is there.
Okay.
But that's, trying to think of that zoning. Is that commercial service today, Kelly, you know, or is that retail?
You know,
I'm not even sure if it's non-conforming today. It could be. It's been there a long time.
Okay. All right. I think Councilmember Newsom has a follow-up, and then I'm going to go to Councilmember Funk.
I found my other question. I tried to number them. On page 40, it talks about allowed and conditionally allowed uses. Staff will provide a complete list of allowed and conditionally allowed uses with the draft zoning code based on council and community feedback once the draft is complete. What is the time frame, and do we have the potential to see what the allowed and conditionally allowed is for each one of these MU 1 through 4?
We aim to have the entire draft zoning code available for our meeting in April.
And at that time, council can make decisions on allowed? And then
that will not be final code adoption. And so that is a check-in on anything that's been covered previously in our segments that we're breaking up. And we'll also be highlighting any other more significant changes.
Okay, and that'll be segmented as well with our recusals. So you'll have it broken down between M1, M2, M3, M4.
I think we will be breaking down every future presentation.
Sorry.
For you.
Thank you. I know it's so much work.
The meeting on the 24th, we will not be discussing mixed-use zones, but we'll be discussing all other commercial zones. And that's sort of the first time that we'll have use tables. And so that'll be a first look at not necessarily mixed-use zones, but other commercial zones, the use tables. And so that'll give you some idea in terms of the thoughts for uses for commercial zones in general.
And I know when we looked at this early on where we were talking about, you know, nodes and different areas, it's so spread out and split, like having two different directions. It's hard to figure out what activities there without mentally driving down ECR and going, oh, that's there on that street. So having it actually broken down with locations tied out to the colors in the zoning districts will be helpful for us to determine if that fits with that node. Thank you.
Okay, Councilmember Funk.
Yes, could you go back a couple of slides or two to the picture that shows Chase and the things next to Walgreens? Chase and Verizon. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so looking at the building that currently houses Chase and Verizon, how does the siting of that building compare with the setback requirements of the proposed code for MU4?
So That's a little bit of a complicated question. So it would not be set back far enough to accommodate a street tree. I don't know the width of the building. And so potentially if you were to take that by itself and put a tree on one side and a tree on the other side that was larger, it might meet the setback requirements and the street tree requirements.
Okay, so that would be, you know, you'd have to put street trees on one side or the other of the building, but or move the building back.
Correct.
You know, to, I mean, you wouldn't move this building because it's there, but.
Yeah, I don't think we want to pick up a whole building and move it. That's right.
No, we're not going there. But and
we did save that little oak tree there, though, so.
Yeah. And then in the, as we're going through this process, pursuant to my colleague's questions, if as we go, as we circle back with this and we look at the allowable land uses that are associated with these particular things, if we come back and decide that we need to change the borders of some of these areas because existing land use and traditions create a problem for doing that, can we circle back and make adjustments to this work in light of what we're learning with regard to the way the land uses are working out?
You can make adjustments to the boundaries of the zoning districts within the general plan designation. We are past the point of moving the general plan designation lines. So if there's a line between mixed use and commercial and you want to move that, that is not something we can necessarily do under our current EIR. We would have to look at that a lot closer.
Okay, but if we can decide that we can change it from one MU4 to another, or we could bump it from, I guess we, I'm sorry, come back at me again. If we wanted to take some of these properties that are currently in, say, MU4 and, you know, a Figaro Tire or something, if you wanted to move that into some other classification, can't do at this point?
So we can change the zoning within the general plan designation as long as the general plan designation doesn't change. So, for example, the general plan calls out one mixed-use district, and it has these four zoning districts that implement it. So we can move around those four mixed-use districts as we see fit and change all the standards within them, but we can't change at this point the place type, which is a general plan designation, because we've already basically finished the environmental impact report. And to change the land use boundary now at this point would be a significant setback for the publication of the EIR, which we'll publish on Monday. So, and that goes out for a 45-day review period. It has all those set timelines to it. So it would kick that down the road a bit because we'd have to go and change that analysis. It changes the numbers of a series of reports that went into it. So we're a little bit fixed on that.
Okay, got it. So we need to do a different solution if we find, if we run into some issues there, or work with, you know, moving it between MU4 to MU1 and that kind of thing, but it has to stay within this general MU place type. Got it. Thank you.
I'm going to ask a follow-on question to that and then go to Councilmember Peak. You mentioned the EIR, and I had wondered about this, whether it's in this MU or one of the others. If we are, you know, we choose to allow a substantial amount of either horizontal or vertical mixed use in the form of residential units above or behind these commercial properties, that affects the amount of traffic, et cetera, you know, coming out onto El Camino Real. How has that been addressed in EIR in terms of the potential for the number of residences or the number of driveways or the number of whatever? Because I feel like we have the potential of being adding a significant amount of potential residential units here. Has that been addressed in the EIR?
Yes. So the EIR has addressed baseline numbers for these mixed-use districts, and we bumped them up to, I mean, essentially what the maximum density would be in these mixed-use areas for the general plan evaluation for the EIR. So it did evaluate traffic and air quality and noise and all of those things based on these areas adding the residential density.
So if we chose in some of these cases, we're saying 35-foot maximum, which essentially is three stories or something. If, for example, we said, no, in that particular area, it should only be two stories or 24 feet or something, it potentially would actually have less impact than that envisioned as a maximum in the AR, in the EIR?
It could. It have slight changes, yes. It wouldn't be, I don't think those kinds of changes would be substantial enough unless you did a substantial amount of properties with that same thing. But the idea here is that you do have the flexibility to change the nuances, change building heights, change densities on certain properties without having a substantial change to our project description. That's what's most important.
And we're certainly not in danger because of what you just said of adding, go through this process, adding units that would change the AR. We're covered.
For the most, yes. Okay. We're pretty well covered unless you really do a big shift, a big change.
Got it. Okay, thank you. Councilmember Peak.
Yeah, MU4, I think in the way it's drawn out here, in those four areas for vertical, I think those are pretty much a no-brainer in my opinion. The Del Rio, then you have the west side of El Camino Real going down towards around 2400 El Camino Real, with that new commercial metal building in the back. You know, being that it would be mixed use moving forward, obviously that building is going to stay the way it is, commercial. And that little house in the front would be part of the new zoning. And then down again, also down to Cubarel, on south of Cubarel, those two sides of the street. This doesn't seem like it's going to like materially affect anything different in town. I think those are already high traffic areas, and I don't see a problem with the way it's proposed here at all. And I we're going to talk about MU1, but there's parts of that that interface with MU4 potentially. I don't know if that's a point for me to ask questions about now, being that it kind of affects MU4, but it's not.
If it's very related to MU4, go ahead, but otherwise we'll save it for MU1.
Yeah, so I'm just going to finish here then. When we get to MU1, I'll ask the questions then. But I think that the way it is here, I think a lot of this is already trending that direction anyway. And it's important to note that these massive parking lots that are half empty all the time would greatly benefit from utilizing the space, especially where you have like Smart and Final down the south end of town. I, for one, would like to see trees on the side of the road with a new building. And I think a lot of those lots are large enough to where any future development, having some trees added in there wouldn't be as detrimental as it would be to like the MU1 areas, which were much more shallow lots. But in general, the MU4 zoning district here as proposed, I don't have any problem with anything proposed here.
Thank you. Questions on this. Speaking of that, you know, you've got a couple of large places here, Smart and Final, Councilmember Pig mentioned Food for Less, where you have a lot of what seems to be unused parking most of the time. I can't think of a time I've ever, you know, going to one of those places and seeing more than half of the parking spots filled up. We're suggesting in this that some building could be built, either in theory, tear it down and build something taller, but building a new structure in those places. I don't see any addressing of like parking standards being changed or something. That would have to happen at some point in time though, right?
So for example, the property there where Smart and Final is has several parcels that are vacant at the street at El Camino Real. They're covered with asphalt right now. They have parking spots on them, but they're actual parcels that could be developed with these kinds of projects without substantially impacting the parking. Now we have to run parking numbers, but as everyone's aware, it is overparked today. Parking for retail is often overdone with these centers, so there's definitely space for it. They could also design something with tuck under parking or other kinds of parking methods to fit in there. But that's a great example because those are existing parcels out there right now that are available, just never have been occupied.
Okay. Thank you. But if we allow mixed use, they might be more likely to have something go in on them because we obviously have too much, just like every city in America, too much retail zoned property. So, okay, back to the picture Councilmember Funk made note of like the Verizon Chase Bank thing. My question on that is, because it always concerns me, if we're to say that this would not be allowed under this proposed thing because it doesn't have enough of a front setback, is that correct?
No, actually, it could still be allowed. The idea with the setbacks is you have notches in buildings for trees, you have trees on the side of the building, so this might actually work because of its narrow width. It's missing street trees, and a street tree could go where you see the fire hydrant there. If the fire hydrant wasn't there, for example, or off to the other side, but just the way this got developed, they decided to do street trees in a different way or not at all. Yeah. So it's not to say that the building couldn't be at that setback. It's just to say that we need to accommodate the landscape somehow.
Right, because I do think, I mean, this kind of, you know, a couple of bushes thing does add, when you add building after building, it does add to the concrete jungle effect. If you've ever walked or ridden a bike along El Camino in August, you definitely notice it and wish there was a tree or two. But it all, on the other hand, it does concern me whenever I look at a building and say, okay, we're proposing that we would not allow that today. So it's good to know we would allow, but we would require, you know, more greenery, so to speak. Okay, other question is, you know, I think Genevieve made note of a correction that we don't have minimum ground floor going through these MU 1 through 4 of 12, 14, 15, 16 feet. It looked like we just have, she had a chart up here that looked like we're only saying 12 and 16. Like, my question is, what is the, it's hard for me to understand the distinction between 15 feet and 16 feet for a minimum ground floor in terms of, you know, directing that upon a commercial property owner. I mean, I understand, you know, there's a distinction between 12 and 16 or even 12 and 15, but I think we did away with the 14 number, or you guys did, but what's the difference between 15 and 16?
I don't think there's much difference between 15 and 16. So I think the direction tonight we're looking for are there certain zones where that that taller ceiling height to allow greater flexibility and sort of higher intensity commercial use is important? And are zones where that is potentially a little bit less important? We still want commercial height to some of our ceilings. There's HVAC systems to accommodate and all of those kind of things. So it's not a typical residential style height. But are there zones where a 16-foot lower floor height is desired and sort of necessary for the types of uses we're envisioning? And then are there areas where maybe that is not as critical?
Well, I just think having too many of them, you know, having 12, 14, 15, 16 is too many. It would be my observation on that. But what I certainly think they should be required in certain areas to ensure that they're usable for commercial. And correct me, I don't want to get ahead of myself if this comment pertains to something other than MU4. I think it pertains to all of them. Genevieve made the comment, and it's in the staff report, regarding you potentially require, let's say, a higher ceiling height on first floor, but still allow residential if it's currently more viable. My concern about that is, if something is built as residential on the first floor, it doesn't matter how tall the ceiling is, it's going to stay residential. Because, again, we go to the fact that if somebody then wants to do something commercial, they can do it somewhere else, most likely. And somebody, I don't know if this comment doesn't
take
that
is specific to the mixed use one area where.
Then I'll hold that. I'll hold that comment.
Where those questions are a little bit more open.
Thank you. I'll hold that comment or question until MU1. Okay, I think we've touched our concerns and given guidance on MU4. Are you guys good with what we've said? Yeah, it's a good question. We don't have very many folks here, so I think we'll go ahead and open it up to any public comment regarding MU4. Max, your mic isn't on, I don't think. There you go.
Max Zappas, local broker developer. Just wanted to touch on the previous